This is the Radio Walensky Podcast. I'm Richard Walensky with new and archive interviews from the Probabilities and Bookwaves Art Waves programs on KPFA-FM and Pacifica Syndication. Dan Simmons, who died on February 21st, 2026, at the age of 77, was an award-winning author of science fiction, fantasy, horror, and mystery fiction. Winner of the World Fantasy Award for his novel Song of Kali, the Hugo Award for Best Novel for Hyperion, along with several Locus Awards for different genre novels and nominations for many other awards. Various novels have long been optioned and sit in development hell, while his horror novel, The Terror, became the entire first season of an anthology series titled The Terror in 2018, and it now streams on AMC+. On February 22, 1991, Richard Lupoff and I interviewed Dan Simmons while he was on tour for his horror novel, Summer of Night.
In a career that's now been running for over a decade, and as you mentioned a few minutes ago, some seven books, seven novels, that is, and a fistful of short stories, you've won high praise for your originality in such novels as Song of Kali, the Hyperion series, and Carrion Comfort. In your new book, Summer of Night, it seems that you've entered what is often perceived as Stephen King country. Would you care to comment on that?
Sure. First, I could say it's a bloody curse being praised for being original every time, because then people get the odd idea that you should be original every time. But I don't think that's the problem with Summer of Night being in Stephen King territory. Stephen King entered Ray Bradbury territory, and who knows, maybe Bradbury entered Mark Twain territory. The territory I entered in the new book, Summer of Night, was the territory of my memory of the summer of 1960 in a small Illinois town. And if you're going to make it suspense horror novel, that it obviously is going to have contact with King's themes and so forth. But it was a celebration of a year that I loved as a kid.
Now, your first novel was Song of Kali, is that correct?
That's correct.
Now that takes place in Calcutta. Did you go to Calcutta?
Yeah, the novel is set in 1977, and by strange coincidence, I traveled through India through the summer of 1977. It was an exciting time because Mrs. Gandhi had just been removed from office for being too dictatorial. The nation was celebrating democracy. So I went with a group of educators to take a look at the society. I only spent about 3 days in Calcutta, but it obviously made an impression on me. And when I did want to write a book where a city became a metaphor for evil, Calcutta came to mind.
Now, that book uses the metaphor of a female destructive engine, which is Kali, which is the same kind of characterization used in Hyperion with the Shrike, as well as perhaps Melanie in Carrion Comfort. Do you see this as some kind of theme running through your books?
I'm not sure. I like metaphors made concrete, I guess, or made, in this case, bone and gristle and fangs. And so maybe Kali and my prickly shrike and Hyperion and Melanie Fuller are facets of the same dark gem. I don't know. Kali, though, is what I had to do is simplify. Obviously, the religion is very complex and often very beautiful, and I simply want it as a metaphor for the darker side of things.
That book had an interesting publishing history. It was picked up by, I believe it was Blue Jay and Jim Frankel.
That's right.
Yeah. Had you sent it over the transom to him? How did it come about?
Luckily, I did have an agent at the time. Richard Curtis read Song of Kali and liked it. And a writer friend, Harlan Ellison, had recommended me and said I might have some potential. So Richard did sell it to Blue Jay.
Now, that book went on to win the World Fantasy Award. Was that a shock to you?
I don't know. When you're starting writing, you know, it could have won an Academy Award and nothing's a total shock. You assume that the birth of your first book is such a cosmic event. Everybody will notice a supernova in the sky. I also was realistic to know that it would win the Fantasy Award and I would put the award on my desk somewhere and then people would essentially forget the book for a while, which is exactly what happened. It just disappeared. So it was several more years before the next novel came out.
Is it in print now?
That's a good question. Somebody told me yesterday it wasn't. I'll check as soon as I get home.
And then you came out with Phases of Gravity, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, that was published by Bantam Spectra. And that's about an astronaut and his dreams. What brought you to write that particular book?
an interest in the topic, the idea of someone going on an epistemological quest, really someone in midlife who's wrestling with some basic philosophy. And why I chose an astronaut is essentially that his walk on the moon was the highest point in his life. It was the truest moment he's ever had. At the same time, those hours on the surface of the moon were as empty as a simulation. It was just one more simulation in a life of simulation and preparations. And so in his 50s, with his wife left him and his son in a religious cult, he decided to go out and try to find what wasn't a simulation. So it was a topic that interested me.
And in that one, you did not go into the good and evil.
That's right. It wasn't about good and evil. It was just about a person trying to understand relationship with other people and with the earth.
Have you read much of Barry Melsberg's works?
I'm sorry, I haven't. I remember reading a little bit and then being excited about reading more, and I just haven't.
Oh, it's just that he did a series of novels. He seemed to get an ID fix from time to time, and one of them was The Lonely or Stranded Astronaut, which he recycled through several novels and uncounted short stories. And I thought there might be a certain relevance between that and your own book that you've just been discussing, Faces of Gravity.
Not in terms of literary influence, I don't believe, but probably in terms of that fixation and returning to the same point, yes.
Okay, now we come to your two epics, which I think is more or less what you're known for, which is the Hyperion novels and Carrying Comfort. Which did you write first?
Carrying Comfort came first.
Now, its original publisher was Dark Harvest. Did you have a problem getting it published?
Yes, and I don't know how many people out there are interested in the sad travail of a book wandering around hunting for the light, but that was an epic. The novel, when you say epic novel, it usually means F-A-T. It's a big, heavy, fat book. But the tale of its publication is epic. It was going to be a Blue Jay novel. The week I delivered the manuscript, the company went bankrupt. It was swallowed up by another publisher who spent a year and a half. And I had quit work at the time, ready to revise and get the second half of my advance and go on to a literary career. And they sat on it deciding, well, two books, three books. Well, maybe half the book it is. Well, maybe no books. So eventually I bought it back. And then a very fine publisher wanted to publish it. But the editorial suggestions were a little harsh, such as throw out everything but the title and start over. But they had a built-in guarantee that they would make me this superstar new Dean Koontz. All I had to do was throw out 98% of my novel. So I said, thank you very much. No thanks. Finally found a publisher in Chicago, Dark Harvest, who said, you send it to us and we'll print it as is. And so I let the book find its own audience.
Now, did that come out at that point after Hyperion had come out, or were we still talking pre-Hyperion?
It's still pre-Hyperion.
Now, that book deals with, I guess you'd call them mind vampires. I'm about a third of the way through it, and a part of me doesn't want to know what happens at the end. It's riveting. Early on in the book, you have a character tell the story of his adventures, if you want to call them that, in a death camp, concentration camp. Where did you draw on that material from?
Nothing personal, nothing in my family, not very much from people I've known. I've only known two people who had any direct contact with the death camps. It came from a very long obsession, maybe too strong a word, but this sense of never having the camps and the Holocaust far out of my mind. I think it's the singular event of the 20th century. And the danger in putting it in a horror novel about anything with the word vampire around it, even mind vampires, which are just people who use other people. The danger is, of course, trivializing a subject that should not be trivialized. So I thought long and hard about that section.
Now, these mind vampires are these people with power who use. Is this a metaphor for, dare I call it, the ruling class in the world at large? Do you believe that there is some sort of group of people who are really running the show in a kind of cabal or conspiracy?
Yes and no. I don't believe there is a group of redneck industrialists or anyone else who are running the world. I do believe that in every group you are in every social interaction that probably is more than you and your lover, and sometimes that too, what it amounts to is that people are exerting power in a way that to me is equivalent to violence, interpersonal violence. And I went to college in the 60s, and the radical movement that never quite became a revolutionary movement was fascinating, but they had the same quota of mind vampires of people who were using others to, for their own personal ends as any other group I've ever been in.
Do you see that mind vampire set having, removing it slightly from the vampire element, but bringing it back toward what we know and see? Do you see that those people more firmly in control in this country?
No, not necessarily. I think there's a something centrifugal going on in this country, that things are flying apart in the sense that they're coming to their most stable organization, which is the community, the family, and not much larger than that, taking care of business right around where you live and what's important to you. And when that happens, I think whatever cabal is out there waiting to try to rule us has less power over us. So I'm rather encouraged, actually.
Even despite events such as the Persian Gulf War?
Yes, despite the Persian Gulf War, I see thousands of vectors leading to the Persian Gulf War, and I see one person deciding it's going to happen. But one of the things I think that we're all in conflict about internally with the war is how in many ways it's really irrelevant to us. It seems to me that we're all working from out-of-date scripts and reacting to the war and discussing it.
You hint that Ronald Reagan, among others, is one of those mind vampires. Is
No. He wasn't a mind vampire.
No, well, he's invited. He's invited to the island, certainly.
Yes, he's invited to the island, but that's during the week when the VIPs come to the island as their private camp to let their hair down and act like morons. However, they're essentially the victims of the mind vampires. To be a mind vampire, you really need a mind. Neither Reagan nor the other politicals are there.
Exactly that thought when that question came up.
You draw in a variety of different conspiracy ideas in this, whether it be John Lennon, Jack Ruby, so on and so forth. I take it then you don't see that kind of conspiracy, but this is just a way to create a horror novel about evil.
Yeah, my working title for the book originally was Paranoia. I think conspiracies make us feel better. The people I know who are firmly entrenched in their conspiracy beliefs feel a little more secure instead of having chaos ruining our lives, both as a nation, individuals. We end up working against some concentrated group that might be defeated. I don't personally believe that.
After Carrie and Comfort, you came out with the books Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion. Was that intended as a single volume?
Yes, although it wasn't carefully worked out either by my publisher or myself. They were two science fiction novels I was going to get out of the way to get onto something else. And they exploded or imploded, I'm not sure which, into something else and just got too big to manage. I did have a disclaimer. I have to apologize to any readers if there's anyone out there who read Hyperion and found out on the last page that the tale did indeed continue, although in different form in the second book. We had caveats all over the book in the original copy, and they disappeared by the time the hardcover came out.
Hyperion and Fall of Hyperion bring together a number of disparate elements in science fiction, which brings me to the question of what did you read when you were growing up? What do you read now? Certainly, Carrie and Comfort contains elements of a variety of different horror novels, so you must be somewhat familiar, particularly also with your new book, Summer of Night. But Hyperion brings in Ursula Le Guin, cyberpunks, a detective story in there. What did you read? What do you read?
Sadly, I don't read too much science fiction anymore. I was rather rejuvenated by the cyberpunk era in that, hey, this is a shot in the arm, if nothing else. And I'm also excited that some of the more literary SF writers have had a chance to be heard. When I was in fourth grade, my brother brought down a giant trunk for Christmas, which he didn't intend as a Christmas present. He just put it under the tree. It was several hundred Ace double novels and F and SF.
Great.
Yeah, that did it. That's what I read. I tend to genuflect when the name Jack Vance is mentioned and so forth.
Now, what year was this?
About 1957.
So you were reading Philip K. Dick and
yes.
Silverberg,
right.
Vance, that whole Damon Knight, that whole...
Yeah, and none of them had been anointed. No one had climbed to sainthood at that point. They were just all in the same vat of wonderful stuff.
Your decision to make the first part of Hyperion kind of a Canterbury Tales, Decameron, brought in the ability to use different kinds of science fiction. How deliberate was that to make each as different from the other?
It wasn't terribly calculated. Once I began the first tale as a tale that somebody would tell, and I knew that there were more stories to be told, then it more or less had to take some Canterbury shape, which had its drawbacks, but it also had some real power to it in the sense that you could have fun with the different styles, detective styles, cyberpunk styles, and so forth. And you could really make it a celebration of the different aspects of science fiction.
Do you find it easy to shift gears in that fashion?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think which is part of not having your own style, but still resonating to all the things that just delighted you as a reader.
When you were talking a few minutes ago about Harry and comfort, and I suppose throughout your works, some of these themes about good and evil, conspiracy theories, the nature of society, and so forth, would you comment on the proposition that still one of these books is just a story? Or is it not just a story? Do you feel strongly about things like allegory, secret revelations, conspiracy theories, and the like?
I think when you get down beneath everything else, it is a story. I take the just out. It is a story. That is the driving force. It is the engine. It is 90% of the cargo to me. I enjoy putting other things in. I tend to shy away from allegory and symbolism and so forth, simply being an English major in college. It makes my gorge become buoyant when I, you know, when that stuff is heavily handed, put in. On the other hand, the books that I return to over the years, you can continue mining at different ages of your life and different points in your education, quite honestly. And so I rather enjoy making connections to larger works. The science fiction novels Hyperion started out as sort of just a slight joke about John Keats and became, at least as far as my abilities were able, an homage to Keats. I learned how brilliant the man was, which I had evaded me for years. So in the act of writing, the respect just grew and deepened beyond belief.
Yeah, I was going to ask what your background was with Keats, because it almost seems as if you may have written a thesis on it in one time.
Well, I did. It's called Hyperion.
Right. The hegemony is interesting, and you've got these portals that open between world to world, which I've never encountered before. How did you come up with the idea for that?
Well, the idea of matter transmitters and teleportation is old hat.
Sure, I know that. But
it's fun to imagine. I hadn't run into, as far as I know, unless it was some Ur document back in my six-year-old subconscious, I hadn't run into a situation where these transmitters were just doorways so you could have a room. I'm sorry, you could have a house with maybe 15 rooms looking out on 15 different worlds. And that I like the one where the guy walks down a stairway through his Farcaster door, and then he's in the topmost tower of a building because the Farcaster connects it. So I had fun with that concept.
Yeah, I like that the river, the mall.
The river flows through, but on 100 different worlds.
That's right, yeah. You have also a character named Mayna Gladstone, who is the president of the hegemony. Reminding me sort of, was she Margaret Thatcher? Was she Golda Meir? Who do you see her as?
Certainly there's an element of Golda Meir, which is, in my mind, quite a bit different than Margaret Thatcher. Somebody told me she was just Abe Lincoln in drag, but I didn't appreciate that.
Well, you do seem to have a predilection for interest in women political leaders. We opened this conversation talking about Indira Gandhi.
Yes.
And now we're on to Margaret Thatcher and Golda Meir. Do you see any, is there some great matriarchal archetype at work there?
No, I don't think it's dealing from matriarchal archetype. I tend to think that I enjoy speculating about potential. And really, I mean, in terms of our country, one of the greatest potentials we have, one of our hopes for the coming century, is tapping into female political leadership. It simply has been ignored up to this point, and it's going to change the way we live and think. And it's too easy in science fiction to have strong female characters who are spaceship captains and soldiers and so forth, who are simply, again, that male figure in drag. But with political leaders, we will get new sensitivities, I believe. Not female sensitivities, but new perceptions that have been shut out of the arena.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your short stories. And since we were just talking about Hyperion and the Farcasters, I noticed Farcasters are present in a short story of yours called Death of the Centaur, which I found a fascinating short story. It seems to me that there must be a lot of autobiography in that.
It's probably the most autobiographical story that I've written. It's about a year I spent more or less stranded in a small Missouri town as a teacher who didn't have enough money to go anywhere else. And the relationship with a group of kids, both teacher-student relationship, but also the teacher tells a story every day. In the short story, the teacher becomes a villain in my eyes by abandoning the children. The children have to end this epic fantasy tale. That year of 1971, when I was teaching in a small Missouri town, I didn't abandon the tale, at least. We finished the year with the end of a story that I told half an hour each day for 182 days. That'd be a lot of pages. And it had little elements in it, such as a monster called the Shrike, and the portals called the Farcaster, and many wonderful things that I haven't touched yet.
But I'd like to talk about, or rather like you to talk about this story a little bit more. What I'd particularly ask you to comment on is my personal response to the story as a reader, and I'm just one out of X many thousand.
Okay.
The alternating sections of the story as written and published are the experiences of this elementary school teacher in Missouri, alternating with a high fantasy or science fiction, at least fantastic adventure, set on another planet with monsters and Farcasters and so forth.
Right.
To me as a reader, the scenes in Missouri were far more compelling than the scenes on the alien world.
Good.
Okay, now that's much too long a question, but I'm trying to provoke an answer from you.
That's a good observation. Part of it is that I didn't want the alien world to dominate the tale. I really wanted people to think about the small Missouri town. And quite honestly, when it comes down to it, that is the great strength that almost all contemporary mainstream fiction has, which is powerful perception of what's around us is usually much more interesting than even the best thought out alien world. So in this case, it was the tale of the alien world and the other planet that was the small metaphor. And the school and the children were the important part.
Even though the alien world has all of the trappings of glamour and romance, and the school was extremely mundane, and yet it evokes a strong, much stronger visceral response from the reader.
I'm glad to hear it. You're the first reader who's responded to that story that I've heard.
Oh, really? I thought I was so ordinary.
Before we get to Summer of Night, which I think picks up this strain very strongly in terms of your own feelings and, I would guess, the mainstream element of Dan Simmons. You write books that are science fiction and books that are fantasy, but books that are horror, excuse me.
That's okay. One of them won the World Fantasy Award, so we can't rule it out.
That's true. Do you see your readership as the same readers going from one to the other, or are they somewhat distinct? Do you have people who say, oh, Hyperion, I'll read that, never touch the horror, such as Carrion Comforter, Summer of Night, and others say, well, I would read those and not read Hyperion. How do you see your readers?
Without being flippant, I have to say I don't see my readers at all. One of the things that I've thought about occasionally is I've never seen anyone reading my book. I've never sat on an airplane and watched anybody else. They read Steve King, they read Dean Koontz. I'm not griping about that, but I have no visual image or preconception about who my readers are. I know some writers who have a very specific image. It's a lady, you know, 53 years old who lives in Grand Island, Nebraska, and has a small white farmhouse just on the edge of town. And I've never been able to do that. What I trust and what I'm staking my career on, not to be too melodramatic, is that really what readers want is a writer that they trust and that they will forgive if they screw up occasionally, but they trust and they will follow that writer to see what the writer has to offer.
That's a fascinating statement. What do you mean by trust?
I mean trust, the old phrase was to give good weight, which is to be an honest merchant and to do one's best. Trust in the sense of not giving up and resorting to formula and artificial melodrama. Trust in the sense of touching something in every reader's life that means something to them. Doesn't have to be some peak experience, but being an honest enough observer that the reader will respond to something human in the story. And you know, in the writing you do, that no matter what world we're depicting or what alien creature is moving around on it's the human aspect of it that fascinates us.
Well, but to go then from the literary to the mundane. I'm going to ask you a very, very pragmatic type question. You tend to write rather long books. The newest one, Summer of Night, is well over 500 pages. Carrying Comfort is roughly 1,000. How long does it take to write such a book?
Most of Carrying Comfort was written in 7 months. And I can't mention the name, the title of the book without my wife just flinching and saying, don't say that out loud. And I was teaching half-time at the time. In fact, not just teaching, but running a district gifted talent program that absorbed 40 hours at least a week, half-time. So it was one of those exertions that you may want to try once or twice in your life. Long books take a while, obviously, you know that.
If you wrote that in 7 months, and the book from beginning, I would gather, to end, certainly as far as I've gotten, is amazingly intense. Were you just like living Carrying Comfort even while you were doing everything else?
No, because the 40 hours of working with the young, talented students kept my sanity and allowed me to step out of that world so that I had the equivalent of that little Missouri classroom, you know, that would be a nice place to be rather than the exotic spot. But it was, I was living in enough that it consumed me while I was working on it, and I worked on it every free minute. And the bulk of it was done in 7 months. It did. There were 6 months on either side of that where I actually was able to work on it. Big books, I think, are sort of the bane of the industry right now. Some readers like them, but as a big book writer, I'll say too many are being written.
Are you going to continue to write big books then?
I just completed a novel that's 348 manuscript pages, but they're very short chapters.
Without going into any detail, if you were to pick a genre, which one would that book be?
The new one?
Yeah.
I'm afraid that's the hardest question you could ask, because I wrote the book with a contract for a publisher who is, again, willing to follow me almost anywhere, but they're not going to follow me into this book. The book has been criticized not by my editor, but by the top publisher in this company as far too intellectual, far too cerebral, and far too horrific, which I thought was an interesting combination of sins. So I will be searching elsewhere. I have no idea what genre it will end up.
Dan Simmons, your new book, Summer of Night, takes place, as you said, in your own childhood. Are you Dale?
You got me.
There's another character, a short, fat kid who is a brilliant writer, Dwayne. Is he real? Was he real?
I usually get bothered as a reader when I hear the author telling who the real people were, because for me, Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn are the real people, and Tom Blankenship is nobody. I didn't know him. Dwayne, I will comment on, though, because he's a character I care for. He's a chubby boy, an outcast, who is brilliant, son of a, just had a father on a small farm. The father's an alcoholic. Father's also very smart, but one of these people who will never succeed. Dwayne was an amalgam of two friends of mine, one of whom, named Keith, I'm happy to say, is a professor of classics in a prestigious Midwest school and doing very well. The other, named Dwayne, was murdered, and at least partially because of his brilliance. And so, in a sense, I was exercising a few ghosts there.
So Dwayne is not going to grow up to be Sheriff Gentry.
They do seem, Steve King was visiting my home recently. He said, you know, you just kill the same person twice, the character named Dwayne in this book and Gentry in another book.
The character of Saul in Carrying Comfort is similar to a character, a Jewish scholar in Hyperion. Were you aware of that similarity at the time?
Yeah, I was. I think what you're revealing here to the world over the airwaves is I tend to recycle certain, if not the actual characters, certainly character types. And if it's a weakness, so be it.
Well, I don't know if it's a weakness, but I think it's a very interesting practice, which I noticed and would like you to comment on a different level. For instance, in your short story, Metastasis, is that pronounced right?
I think it's Metastasis.
All right. For starters, this is a harrowing story about cancer, which is not exactly the world's cheeriest subject, but you somehow manifest this in the form of strange creatures, cancer vampires, with snout-like proboscis face, which slips cancer slugs into the victim's body. Now, in Summer of Night, there's a very, very similar phenomenon that takes place where a sort of zombie World War I soldier lurching around in the 1960s, and at another point, a priest who was taken over by evil. develops this snout-like proboscis and goes injecting slugs of sheer evil into their victim. Was this deliberate and conscious on your part?
Yeah, but you know when you're repeating yourself with the cancer vampire laying these slug, they're not just slugs. The slugs emerge from the eggs that are the tumors, so they hatch hundreds of thousands of these things in us. I'll stand by that one. I'm proud of it because what I was hunting for was an equivalent, an analog to the horror that is cancer that we're so used to. And elsewhere, I think I've written that I think too often we're like the residents and the happy civilians outside Dachau or Auschwitz who see the cattle cars going by and see the smoke and the orange glow from the crematoria, but we will not bother ourselves with paying attention. And with a scourge such as cancer and now AIDS, there are too much of a human urge to ignore it. So I wanted something that really shocked people. And then people who say, that's disgusting, this proboscis penetrating us and laying these terrible eggs that will hatch into slugs that devour us. Is it as disgusting as cancer? No. But we haven't thought about it that way for a while. To answer your question, the second time I used it, it was for horrific effect. And it was essentially just because the idea that a proboscis coming into me scares the hell out of me. I mean, and all of Freudian experts out there can explain that to me. They want.
Enjoy. There were many, many other images summoned up in Summer of Night, and I'd like to hit you with a list of them and get your comments. For one thing, I detected at least second or third level resonances of an H.P. Lovecraft story, The Rats in the Walls, David H. Keller story, The Thing in the Cellar. Some recollections of those wonderful old black and white Roger Corman horror movies of the 1950s.
Which I watch in that small Illinois town.
Weren't they wonderful? Yes, yeah. Yes. And of course, the Free Show in Summer of Night is a direct reference to this. And it seemed to me that yet despite all of these frightening images, there was a wonderful kind of cheery Hardy Boys or Three Investigators feel to the book.
Yeah, the Lovecraft reference is interesting because occasionally out on signing tours, people will come up to me and say, I love your stuff. It reminds me of Lovecraft. And I believe the only Lovecraft I've ever read, and it was when I was rather young, was The Rats in the Walls. I think that's it. So it probably did have an effect. But I really don't care for Lovecraft's philosophy, if you can call it that, this sense of a dark, cold wind blowing from somewhere else, which will just blow every human desire and need right out of the way because it will overpower us, that we have no defense. And I never accept that. Thus the Hardy Boy image. These kids in their old 1956 Schwinns, they'll take on the enemy.
There's something that you referred to several times in Summer of Night that I found intriguing, and I hope it is real. That was the bootlegger's cave. Is that real?
It is absolutely real, although we never found it as kids. Oh. If I went...
Tell about it anyway, would you? Because I just loved it so much.
The bootlegger's cave was one of our local, now they're called urban legends. This was as unurban as you can get out in our little town of about 800 people. Go out to a farm and there's old ruts headed out into the fields and on a hillside. There were looked like remnants of mine shafts or cave openings, but they had been all filled in. And I'm sure they were nothing. I have no idea what they were. But the local legend was that bootleggers in the 20s, early 30s, had come down there and had an entire speakeasy in a cave, which they put outside of town in this county where the police just didn't go. They permitted it. But finally, federal agents found them, dynamited the entrance to the cave, and left inside the whiskey, the bar itself, cars, trucks that delivered the booze, and it was all underground somewhere under this pasture. And so any free moment us guys had and a few of the girls, we'd head out with shovels and start digging up hillsides. And so that's the one thing that the kids didn't find at the end of Summer of Night. The bootlegger's cave is still safely hidden.
But I'm sure it's still there.
I am too. I am absolutely, I believe in the bootlegger's cave.
Great.
Were there rumors in the school there about an evil bell, or is that purely from the book?
That's purely from the book. But I taught for 11 years in a school called Old Central. As a teacher, I know what evil lurks in the hearts of schools. And I do have to say one thing. The book begins with a scene where a chubby little boy goes down into the catacombs of this ancient school, goes to the boys' bathroom, and the kids have been kicking a hole in the wall, and finally he can force his way in. He finds a space, and he disappears in there, only to reappear a few hundred pages later in, shall we say, a less attractive form. In real life, in the school where I taught, a little second-grade boy who was pretty rotund went down, kicked the hole in the wall, got stuck in the back of this big old scary bathroom. But the fun part was that as the other kindergartners and first graders came down with their big key they carried to the restroom, they'd just hear this moaning and eerie sound coming from the wall. The boy was there for 5.5 hours before anybody said anything about it.
Maybe I should stop reading fantasy and science fiction and just read mainstream, because I find that story so much more wonderful than something with fangs and claws. There's just no comparison.
I do, too.
Do you intend on moving more into a mainstream direction?
The hard part is to still be able to write whatever I want to write. And I've said before, and it's come back to haunt me, that the one great blessing of either being unpublished or just when you're beginning, maybe one thing published, is you can write whatever you damn please. As you keep going any direction, it becomes harder and harder to divert from the channel that you're carving. So, yes, I have more mainstream novels, including one with Ernest Hemingway as a character, which I will write. Whether they're published, I don't know.
What about more epic science fiction?
Yes. Hyperion was a celebration of the vast field of science fiction for me, so I can't do that again. But I did have one tale of a woman architect messiah that I've been hunting for years for a society to put her in to make it convincing, and I realized I'd pretty well created that with the Hyperion universe. So I have one more book. I'm on record. One more book set in the Hyperion universe, which I will write. And I'm going to continue strip mining John Keats, so I'll title the book Endymion.
While Dan Simmons' regular publisher was Putnam, his next novel, The Hollow Man, would be published by Bantam. Most, if not all, of his novels are still in print. Richard Lupoff and I would interview Dan Simmons once more in 1997 while he was on tour for his novel, The Rise of Endymion. This interview was digitized, remastered, and edited in May 2026 and has not been heard in its entirety. You've been listening to an interview with horror and science fiction author Dan Simmons, who died on February 21, 2026, at the age of 77. It was recorded February 22, 1991, while he was on tour for his horror novel, Summer of Night. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff. Until next time, I'm Richard Walensky. Radio Walensky usually posts every week on Sundays. You can write to me either at bookwaves@hotmail.com or richard@kpfa.org. You can find other Radio Walensky podcasts in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org, or you can go to bookwaves.homestead.com or richardwalensky.com for a complete listing of all digitized recordings. You can subscribe to Radio Walensky via iTunes or follow Richard Walensky Radio Shows on Facebook.